Hello everyone and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today I am delighted to talk again to Muhammad Jalal. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you again, Paul.
It's great to see you again. You're most welcome. For those who don't remember, you've been on a number of times before, Muhammad is a lecturer in politics in London and hosts the brilliant podcast, The Thinking Muslim. I do recommend this YouTube site. I mean, some fantastic interviews. He also delivers a regular course for young Muslims exploring the thoughts of Islam and liberalism. He writes for numerous online journals, including Traversing Tradition, Muslim Matters, and Cage. And he can also be found on Twitter. And I'll link to his Twitter handle in the description below, as well as to the Thinking Muslim podcast. Do subscribe to both of those if you haven't already. Now, today, Muhammad has kindly agreed to discuss the accusation that's been made recently by a number of people that Muslims are becoming more right-wing. Is this true? Are Muslims dangerously flirting with a conservative right? So that's the accusation. Is it true, sir? Over to you.
Well, Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much, Paul, for giving me this opportunity. It's always a pleasure to be on Blogging Theology, and I really love the content that you manage to create on a weekly basis, and it's enriching, I think, the Muslim conversation. And so many Muslims I meet make references to your great videos and the guests that you have, and I think, you know, it's a sign of the greatness actually that exists within the Muslim community, that you can bring so many various experts on so many issues, and yet, alhamdulillah, it doesn't seem that you're running out of content. So jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for what you do, Paul. So as you said, today I want to talk about, or at least present for the first part of today's session, some thoughts I have on some accusations that have been made or levied against the Muslim community in recent weeks, months, and years about the political status of the Muslim community. I've summarized it into the following title, or at least following question: are Muslims more right? And this is an accusation, if we want to put it like that, that has been levied at the Muslim community, partly because so many Muslims today are exercised at the level of sexuality and sexualization that is creeping into, in particular, children's curricula in schools. And as you've seen in the United States, in Canada, and in the UK, and across Europe, there have been various protests conducted by Muslim community groups protesting against what we see as pretty problematic themes that are finding their way into the books and to the lessons that young Muslims are subjected to. On this opening slide, you see a demonstration, which I think was in Michigan in the United States. And it was a demonstration against one particular state. As you know, the federal system in the United States devolves education to the local states. And this particular state decided that they're going to remove the opt-outs when it comes to the teaching of what we call in the UK personal social education, you know, sexual education. So Muslim parents were suddenly found themselves in a position where they couldn't remove their children from lessons that they believed were pretty much against their basic moral frameworks. And that was causing a lot of problems and challenges from within the Muslim community or within the Muslim community. And so they began to organize. And the net effect of that demonstration, like many of these protests that have taken place in here in the UK, we've seen demonstrations in East London and in Birmingham. The net effect of it was that the left were quickly claimed that Muslims were somehow being utilized by the right in a greater culture war. So we were just mere pawns in this right's endeavor to undermine the liberal left. We've seen a number of pieces written in the last few months, in fact, which I'm going to go into in the next few slides, that discuss what they see to be a growing phenomenon in the Muslim community of right-wing allied Muslims. I wrote a couple of articles in response to these pieces that were penned in places like New York Times. So I wrote a piece for Muslim Matters, which I think we had a discussion about, and you invited me onto the show.
Yeah, I've read it. I'll link to that. Certainly, it's worth reading.
And also I wrote an article, in fact, a response to Shadi Hamid, who wrote a piece about Muslims becoming more right-wing and about the liberal neutral state. That was an article that was published on my Substack. So if you want to access that article, just go to this link here. And I think, alhamdulillah, I mean, Shadi responded to it and he appreciated the points I raised, and we had a good discussion on social media, and we promised to engage on this subject in greater detail in the future. So that was very, very positive in a sense. So here's what I want to address today. I want to really talk about the accusation, the reality that we are confronted with, and that is that wider left-wing society accuses the Muslims of becoming more right-wing, and the flashpoint is really the prevalence of LGBTQ lessons in Muslim schools, to which Muslims are not allowed to question. So I want to first talk about that reality and the left-wing response to it. Then I want to have very quickly explain what is right-wing and left-wing, and maybe how we can, as Muslims, sometimes misunderstand what it means to be left-wing and right-wing. And so often we can characterize our positions, in particular our traditional positions on Islam, to be conservative positions. Now, of course, that's not a problem in per se. We use the language that is available. But of course, conservatism, or at least conservative positions, or the label conservatism comes from comes with a lot of ideological baggage. And I just want to explain that conservatism is broader than, say, a Muslim who holds a traditional view towards marriage, for example. Right. Thirdly, I want to talk about liberal multiculturalism and how that works. And why is it that Muslims find themselves, in particular, as I said, in left-leaning states in the US and actually across Britain? Remember, it was a conservative government of Theresa May that removed the right to opt out of these problematic lessons in schools. Mm. So why do we find ourselves in a position where we're constantly in tension with the liberal state? And where is that going to lead? And I'll give you some of my thoughts about that. And lastly, which was the latter part of the article, the Muslim Matters article, I made reference to my discussions through the Thinking Muslim podcast, my discussions with Muslim leaders in America and Britain, and how I feel that many Muslim leaders, in particular religious leaders and political activists, are trying to move away from this left-right paradigm and are adopting a more political independent stance when it comes to wider society. So I hope to get through these four points as swiftly as I can, and as you know, I tend to use these presentations as ways by which I can remember what I have to say. But also, please do, if at any point I'm just repeating myself, Paul, please do to pull me up on that. So let's talk about the accusation, the argument that Muslims are moving towards the right. So there've been a series of articles that have suggested that Muslims are becoming more right-wing. Now, these articles mainly are based in the US, so these articles come out of the US, and they suggest that the war on terror and the waning of the war on terror, the rhetoric that was pretty hostile after 9/11, that rhetoric has somewhat dissipated over the last 5 years, and we can see that in American society in particular, but also here in the UK, the spotlight that Muslims were subjected to after 9/11, well, that spotlight is somewhat diminished. And as the West now focus on great power enemies like Russia and China, Muslims are less likely to be vilified in the press. Now, I'm you know, potentially exaggerating. Of course, we still see.
I think, as you're going to say, in the US, that may very well be the case. But in places like France, and not just France, in Europe, that probably wouldn't be the case. The point about the war on terror receding may be true or not, but it may, there are other issues that are now bearing down on Muslims in France, particularly, anyway.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And, you know, just think about the Quran burning in Sweden and the horrible rhetoric that's come out of Sweden. I think the Europeans are slow to, and that's partly, by the way, because the Europeans have been very reluctant to confront China as the Americans would want them to. The Americans have now, their rhetoric has moved away from what was a, you know, what were terrorist groups, so-called terrorist groups, and problems with Islam as a religion, and have now moved on to these great powers. But there is a reluctance here in Europe to embrace that American narrative. But it's you know, slowly getting there. The argument goes that the war on terror rhetoric is somewhat dissipating, and as a result of that, Muslims find themselves in a more independent or in an atmosphere which is less intense, and they are as a result, they are adopting positions which for the last 20 years are positions that they did not hold politically. Let me explain that. But 9/11 was an intense, as I said, very intense for Muslims, and Muslims were subject to this very deep securitization. Mm. And a lot of the left, the liberal left in particular, the socialist left, the progressives, they embraced the Muslim community, and they helped the Muslim community to navigate some of these complexities, some of these challenges. And so for 9 or 20 years, the Muslims have been indebted, I suppose, in inverted commas, to the left for helping them. When Trump wanted to ban Muslim countries, the left came out to help Muslims. And as a result of that, many Muslim leaders overlooked some of the excesses and the problems that come from the left because they did not want their allies to desert them. Now, that intense atmosphere has declined. And as a result, Muslim leaders find themselves more open to subject the left to questions about some of their social stances. Mm. And I suppose what Wajahat Ali, who's a liberal journalist who writes for the New York Times, what he captured was this change in mood or change in atmosphere in the Muslim community. However, and I think he's right in that analysis of the Muslims in America. However, he then says that the reason why Muslims are now raising issues such as LGBTQ lifestyles and you know what Muslim children are being taught in schools, it's because those Muslims are being inspired by white supremacists. They're being inspired by a broader culture war, which the Trump Republican right is waging in. And Muslims have sort of been caught up in this dragnet, and so they're unwilling or willing pawns in this greater political game. And that's what I contest, and that's what I'm going to be contesting today.
Yeah. I mean, that my new response is that just denies agency to Muslims. Exactly. Muslims are just passive pawns to be used like chess pieces. It's quite insulting, actually, to Muslims, denying them agency in their own actual views, which have been held for 1,400 years. And so that is a surprising claim, actually. And the idea that Muslims should somehow be inspired by white supremacists is laughable.
For sure. I mean, Wajahat was actually ridiculed, even by some in the left, who said, well, wait a minute, you know, we know that Islam has a position on this. And that position is a very traditional position. So how can you claim that somehow the right are instigators? In fact, many of those protests that have taken place in Michigan and elsewhere in the United States and here in the UK, I mean, there were no right-wing people present. In fact, the right, if they did join, they joined rather late in the day once they saw Muslims were taking a stand on these issues. There was an article written in New Lines magazine by Rasha Al-Akidi, who said that, and there's a quote from her, she suggested that there was a moral bankruptcy of contemporary Muslim dawah or proselytization in the West. And she sort of knits together Andrew Tate and various other dawah influencers and argues that there is this shopping list of right-wing views that are being displayed by these dawah personalities and by these Islamic personalities on social media. And from that, she makes a logical leap or an illogical leap and suggests that, you know, this is all part of a right-wing plot. I engage with the editor of the magazine, in fact, once the article was written. It's a very lengthy piece. And I wrote to him and said, this is pretty ludicrous and it doesn't stand up. And this is not actually the intellectual trend that I see and observe in the Muslim community. And I've, you know, like you, Paul, I've invited a lot of American and UK leaders on my podcast. And this is not what I'm getting from them about the trajectory of the Muslim community. And actually, to his credit, he was very open to that discussion. There's also a piece, in fact, a podcast by Shadi Hamid, where he invited an anonymous Muslim onto his podcast, Wisdom of Crowds. And that anonymous Muslim, it's worth listening to. And you know, he claimed that LGBT and other moral issues are pushing Muslims closer to alliance with Christian evangelicals and Trumpist conservatives. And his argument was that, you know, Muslims need to create these short-term alliances in order to navigate these really choppy waters they find themselves in, these morally degraded waters, I suppose, Muslims find themselves in. And then there's the issue of Hamtramck, and I'm sure I've not pronounced that well in the same way Americans who come to Britain.
Which I've never heard of this word, actually, so yeah. I think you can explain it now.
So Hamtramck is a municipality. It's the only Muslim-run municipality in the States, I believe. It's a very small municipality, and Muslims, in effect, have most of the positions on the council. And of course, America, United States, has a very long history of local democracy, unlike actually the United Kingdom, where it's very centralized still. And so this Muslim mayor has enormous powers, or at least has powers in particular to, he banned the flying of pride flags and any political emblems on mayoral buildings, on state buildings. And that was taken by the left wing in particular as a betrayal. In fact, the former mayor of Hamtramck said in an article that, you know, this is betrayal by the Muslim community. We helped you in the time of need, and now you're taking away our rights, the right to fly the pride flag over the town hall. Mayor Amer Ghalib recently had a series of meetings with Michael Flynn. Now, if you remember, Michael Flynn was National Security Advisor under Donald Trump. He was an ex three-star Army Lieutenant General, and he met with after this incident in Hamtramck, he met with the mayor, and he tried to carve out an alliance with the Muslim community. And he said some very positive words. This is in contrast, by the way, to his earlier statements. Back in 2016, he said Islam is a political ideology masquerading as a religion. In other words, Islam is like communism. It's this political idea, but, you know, they pretend to be a religion. He called for the clamping down on religion in America. In fact, it was people like Michael Flynn who were behind the Muslim ban. Yet his words are very promising, or at least sound very promising for the Muslim community. You know, he said at this conference about the teaching of problematic curricula in schools. They're going to teach them more pornography, forced critical race theory. He said at that meeting. So again, we see that there are right-wing overtures towards Muslims, and we shouldn't paper over that. The right have realized that on moral and social issues in particular, Muslims are actually taking a stand more than their Christian counterparts. And Muslims are at the forefront of attending meetings and protesting against school boards and joining school governorships in order to change that trajectory, change that horrible situation where Muslim children are being subject at a very early age to just over-sexualization. So Muslims came first, and then you can say cynically, and I would say cynically, the right have tried to jump on that bandwagon and co-opt Muslims into their greater party political game.
And I haven't noticed that anywhere in Europe, by the way. I haven't noticed right-wing populist movements in Europe making overtures to Muslims on the grounds that they share common causes. On the contrary, they really don't care about Muslims. They just want them out or silenced or marginalised, like in France. So maybe this is an American thing. I don't know.
I think so. There have been a few minor voices in the UK which I've noticed, but generally speaking, I think
Tommy Robinson comes to mind, actually.
Well, he does,
bizarrely making overtures to Muslims, given all the harm that he's done over the years.
Well, exactly, and you know, he's a deeply problematic person. But of course, you know, there is I suspect in many ways he's echoing the movement in with the American right. Now, these commentators also point out Andrew Tate, who of course became a Muslim, and they argue that a lot of his positions, in particular his positions towards manhood and towards towards men showing their masculinity, they frame these positions under a right wing banner. Now, many of these positions may or may not be right-wing. I mean, you know, I think these positions predate, as we know, the right. And Islam has a very clear position on the Muslim male and his responsibility towards the household and towards the family, some of which people like Andrew Tate echo. Now, by the way, I don't buy this argument that just because Andrew Tate has become a Muslim, that he's no longer subject to scrutiny. I mean, I think there are still very problematic positions he holds socially, and on his social media, he still conveys or portrays a level of fahisha of problematic positions, which I think Muslims should call out and say this is not what we want our young Muslim men to be subject to. But I don't want to focus on that today. What I want to focus on is an interview he gave with Tucker Carlson. Now, Tucker Carlson, of course, I'll come back to him later, has for years, he's been at the forefront of Islamophobia in America, of Islam hatred, really, in America. But he's found that in recent years, in weeks and months, his position towards Muslims has somewhat been diluted. And in this interview, he spoke about Andrew Tate's faith, and they talked about migration. In fact, Andrew Tate's said something deeply problematic. You know, third world migrants that come to Europe would import high testosterone men who would act as fearsome predators in an emasculated West. Now, I find that very problematic. And it sort of echoes that great replacement theory narrative that somehow Muslims who are coming to these countries, because they have this deep sense of masculinity, they're replacing the stock of men who have now been emasculated in the West. And they probably have, but emasculated in the West. And that's part of this greater left-wing plot to somehow, you know, change the demographics of the West and to have compliant left-wing voters, right? If you know a bit about that, the great replacement theory narrative, you know, he was playing to that narrative, and Tucker Carlson was gushing in his praise for that anti-immigration position. Carlson, by the way, recently, last Sunday, visited Utica in Macomb County. And again, I may not be pronouncing those right, where he said that he was more supportive of observant Muslims than the Episcopal church leaders, which he called pagans. And he was an Episcopal church. He grew up in this church, and he said it's basically wicked and it's like paganism. And he said that he respected Muslims who prayed five times a day. Now, this is the same Tucker Carlson who in 2006 called the Iraqi citizens semi-literate primitive monkeys. And he called the Afghans, he said that they could never be a civilized country because the people weren't civilized. In fact, back in 2008, during the election campaign, the Obama election campaign, he said if there were a Democrat to come out in 2008 and say, you know, what the problem is. It's Islamic extremism. It's not terror. It's not some, you know, indefinable threat out there. It's these lunatic Muslims who are behaving like animals, and I'm going to kill as many of them as I can if you elect me. If a Democrat were to say that, he would be elected king, okay? So, you know, if the Democrats came out and said, we want to kill as many Muslims as possible, then that Democrat is a good Democrat, according to Tucker Carlson. Well, this is the Tucker Carlson who has a litany of hatred towards Muslims and Fox News. He's now done an about turn, supposedly, and he speaks favorably, at least with reservations, favorably towards Muslims. So I suppose the question is, with all this so-called positivity, are Muslims moving in that right-wing direction? So let me say a few words about what it means to be right-wing. What is the right-wing? When we say someone is right and someone is left, what do we mean by that? And I'm going to go through this quite quickly. In fact, I remember on an earlier show, we did speak a lot about the right and the left. So I'm not going to concentrate too much on this, but just to say a few words on this slide, of course, the term right-wing and left-wing really comes about after the French Revolution in the 18th century. And it developed out of the positioning of the various parties in the parliament. So those who were pro-king, who were loyal to the monarchy, who believed in tradition, they sat on the right of the speaker. And those who were against that, who were liberal, they sat on the left. So right wing became an idea associated, or became a notion associated, with conservatism. And conservatism was the belief that, you know, we see that here in the UK. If you think about Edmund Burke, if you think about Thomas Hobbes, it's the belief that there is a need to conserve the past, in particular some of the institutions that build the social fabric of society, the church, the monarchy. In the case of Hobbes, you know, feudalism. In the case of Edmund Burke, he talked about the little platoons, you know, the idea that we need to preserve community. This was the conservative position, and the liberal position was characterized as a more revolutionary position. It was a position that wanted to dismantle the monarchy and dismantle aspects of institutions that held modern society back. So typically today, the left wing would be characterized as a broad spectrum. So anarchists and communists and socialists and democratic socialists, the Labour Party, for example, social democrats, left libertarians like the Green Party, progressives, as you can see, the left of the progressives in the Democratic Party, the social liberals, these are all lumped in the left wing. Whereas political scientists, they argue that the right wing would be traditional conservatives, libertarian conservatives, neoconservatives, ultra-conservatism, right libertarians, anarcho-capitalists, monarchists, fascists, and reactionaries. These are all lumped in the right wing. And the reason why I'm pointing this out,
just to be slightly provocative, I guess, in that list of the right, you've got fascists, but the classification of national socialists, i.e. Nazis, as right wing is arguably contestable, because a lot of Hitler's policies are actually left wing and explicitly socialist. That's why the flag is red, in part, because it's meant to be a nationalistic kind of socialism. So I mean, I'm just quibbling here for the sake of it, but but anyway,
it's a good point. It's a very good point, and in fact, as you see today, many who are on the right, in particular in the United States, actually do hold positions which are very anti-capitalist. And these are positions that wouldn't look odd in, you know, a forum with Noam Chomsky, for example. Mm. So it's not very easy. And actually, political scientists do say this, that it's not, you know, these left-right positions, they may be general positions, but actually, when you dig deeper, you will find that there are inherent contradictions in what people actually do and these political spectrum positions. But yeah. for a general perspective, the left wing would be regarded as those progressives and social democrats, and the right wing, as I said, the conservatives. Now, why does this matter? Well, it matters because liberalism has gone through a number of iterations since its early formation in the 17th and 18th centuries. My point that I'm going to make here is that when we talk about the liberal left and the conservative right today, we're not really talking about the conservative and the left in the 18th century after the French Revolution. Because most of the conservatives we refer to today are actually small L liberals.
Yes.
In the sense that these conservatives have appropriated many of the liberal positions that their forebears were against.
Yeah.
If we think about Edmund Burke, you know, as an early proponent of conservatism, or Thomas Hobbes, Edmund Burke initially had a position which was very much against the industrialization and the formation of urban capitalism. I mean, Benjamin Disraeli, the Conservative Prime Minister in the UK, he was very averse to, and he saw the social challenges that capitalism brought. But within time, the Conservatives appropriated those positions and adopted it as their own, right? And actually, the conservatives you see today, like the Republican Party, and you know, again, this is very much an American position, but the Republican Party very much adopt the classical liberal position on many issues. And the modern liberals, so those who today live within the Democrats, or in the UK, most of the Labour Party today could be regarded as liberal. I mean, Tony Blair was certainly a liberal in many ways. These positions, these left-leaning positions, are what we call modern liberal or social liberalism. Let me say that in a more easier way to digest. There are, in effect, two strands of liberalism. I'm oversimplifying this, but two strands of liberalism that emerge over the last two or three centuries. You've got a classical liberalism that believes in freedom and individualism and believes in a neutral state and believes in a minimal state. And then you've got modern liberals who, of course, believe in individualism and believe in equality, but they also believe that the state has a responsibility to nourish and to develop equality in society. And that means that sometimes the state has to take a position which isn't neutral. And so you have these conflicting views. And of course, classical liberals will regard modern liberals as, like John Rawls, would regard Rawls to be someone who has innovated and has reared away from the classical precepts of liberalism. And modern liberals would say, well, we're just doing what liberals should do. We're as time goes on, we're embracing tweaks to liberalism in order to establish, you know, the types of equalities that early liberalism wanted to establish. Now, there is a newer strand of liberalism, which again I may refer to later, called progressivism, which is a sort of more extreme form of liberalism. Progressives came about after the 1960s, and they particularly focus on the politics of recognition. They embrace liberal multiculturalism. They embrace, in particular, sexual morality, and they call upon the state, or sexual immorality rather, and call upon the state to protect those feminist or those hard won rights that many women got in the 1960s. In particular, if you think about Roe v. Wade and abortion rights. This was championed by the new modern liberals, the progressives. And as time goes on, the progressive causes become greater. And so today, progressivism is the protector of trans rights. So there is a debate between the modern liberals and the progressives over trans rights. Many modern liberals say that it's gone too far now. And trans rights is an anathema to women's rights. And, you know, we've got a somewhat...
Some of these so-called people on the right who are criticizing this are actually liberals, but they're old-fashioned liberals. But confusingly, they're now seen as coming from the right, but they're not really, because they're if you look at their philosophy, their worldview is based on autonomy and individualism and personal choice. These are classic liberal values. So it's not really right-wing at all. They're not in the classical sense of a right-wing position, going back to the French Revolution. You get the left and the right there, about order on the right and conservative values on the right and so on, and monarchy. This has nothing to do with the right, the liberalism at all, as it is, modern iterations of so-called right-wing views. This is simply classical liberalism dressed up in a new guise.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's more, by the way, you know, Barry Weiss is an example, and the progressives call Barry Weiss a right winger, but she's actually a modern liberal. You know, she's a cosmopolitan liberal who believes in, you know, most of the ideals of modern liberals. But because she has a position on trans rights, for example, you know, she's now been cancelled by those progressives. My point here is that there are three distinct strands, you can call them, of liberalism that we have to contend with in the West: classical, social liberalism, and these progressive strand. But all of these strands come under liberalism, and the modern Republican Party in the United States and some elements of the Conservative Party in Britain, the Thatcherite element, you know, these are what we call neoliberals. They've gone back to classical liberalism and embraced and adopted some of those ideas that that conservatives in the past rejected. They've embraced them. That's why, by the way, some conservatives, I mean, Peter Hitchens comes to mind, argues that most of the conservative parties now in the West have just given up on conservatism. They're no longer actually conservative parties.
Oh, no, I'm sure he's right. I mean, Hitchens himself is a conservative, but he is what I would call a real conservative, not basically a liberal who's just called a right winger or something. So, no, I think he's a traditional Christian conservative person. And he has a healthy respect. He has said some things in the past which shows healthy respect for, you know, having Muslim neighbors, for example. He said, I'd much rather have Muslims and neighbors than some other kinds of people, because he knows they're going to be honest. He knows their values. They're going to be good neighbors. They're going to be godly people and so on. And this is coming from a true conservative Christian spokesman, Peter Hitchens.
No, absolutely. I think you know, and it, you know, again, there are some things he says that we may have a problem with, and there are other things, you know, that we find very agreeable, in particular, you know, some of his positions on drugs and others. So let me quickly say the left and the right. So we've said this, the left and right are effectively liberal, and they're just different types of liberal, because what's going on there, and I'm going to cut through this, what's going on there is that as the years go on, different strands of liberals, they focus on different aspects of liberalism. See, liberalism is a broad church, and because there's no central authority, or there's no ijtihad, you know, or process by which you derive the rulings from the text. So Muslims, Islam has this very meticulous process, which disables someone from producing a view which is way beyond what is orthodoxy in Islam, you know, way beyond the acceptable remits, the red lines that Islam sets. Well, liberalism doesn't really have that. And so as the years go on, liberals, they devise, or they focus on different aspects of liberalism, to the exclusion of other aspects. And that is what we've seen. And that's an interesting phenomenon that I think we need to think about more. Now, I want to focus on liberal multiculturalism and how we as Muslims interact with the liberal state. Now, I've got a picture here, which did the rounds a few years back.
Great picture.
Some traditional Muslims are going to say, well, why have I chosen to have this, you know, this lady with, you know, and without hijab on the picture? Well, she isn't. It's a man. You know, it's a drag queen. It's a picture that a lot of liberals, it's on a New York subway. And I think the picture was basically sent around to, you know, in a positive way, to say, look, this is where we've come to in you know, the great liberal society, where we can have a multiplicity of moral positions. And, you know, they tend to sort of live together in this melting pot that we call America or New York. Now, progressives in particular endorse what the position or what has become known as a politics of recognition. If you want to read about this, Will Kimlicker is a liberal multiculturalist. And he argues that the state shouldn't only tolerate minorities, whether those minorities are cultural groups, religious groups, or positions like LGBTQ, but rather they need to acknowledge their existence actively through acts of recognition. Charles Taylor, he developed this idea of acts of recognition. So in other words, the liberal state, and that whether it's a Muslim, whether it's a Hindu, whether it's a gay person or a trans person, the liberal state isn't just there to be that neutral arbiter to say, well, okay, fine, as long as no one troubles you, we're going to live and let live. But rather, the liberal state's responsibility is to actively recognize you for who you are and to give you, to place your position in society with a level of importance, right? And so, for example, liberal multiculturalists would say that it's not enough, you know, to tolerate Muslims. You've got to actively endorse Muslims by, say, having Eid celebrations in Trafalgar Square or in Piccadilly Circus. That's an active act of recognition. In the same way, to have a pride ceremony or to teach pride in the curriculum or to teach Black history. All of that comes out of this concept of liberal multiculturalism, of recognition. Now, by the way, classical liberals would say, well, that's going too far because the state, the responsibility of the state is to be a neutral arbiter, not to get involved. Everyone has their own version of the good life. The state doesn't say one version is better than another. The state steps back and it only intervenes if someone is prejudicial towards you and wants to take away your rights as an individual, right? So if you believed in Islam and someone wanted to take that away from you, then the police and the law enforcement would stop them from doing so. Modern progressive liberalism goes one step forward and says it's not enough. You have to actually actively recognize those cultures and those communities. And if you don't, Hamtramck Council, in effect, enacted a grievous wound when they disallowed the LGBT flag, because they, by disallowing the flag, they're disallowing the LGBTQ identity. They've saddled its victims with crippling self-hatred, denying their desires for full self-esteem, and stifling a sense of their own authenticity. And I hope I made that clear. Liberal multiculturalism is about actively recognizing those different minority communities by acts of, as I said, acts of recognition to make them feel comfortable so that the wider society not just acknowledges them, but actively participates in creating and developing their identities.
Could I push back on this? Some might say that this was slightly not quite what was going on, because you could argue, I think, that, okay, there is this progressive agenda to affirm these identities, the state actively getting involved. But that it's not quite equal for all groups. There seems to be a hierarchy, a rigid hierarchy of status. So the LGBTQ issue would presumably be at the very top of the hierarchy. Yes. How do we know this? Because in this example of this council, that their concerns about the flag being taken down, not being put up in the first place, override that of another group of minority victims, the Muslims, whose concerns about, you know, their issues to do with their faith and their religion and their children are completely ignored. Yeah. So I think I might disagree with that, as if there's just a general affirmation of identities as people present them to the state and the state affirms them. There seems to be a privileging of some agendas. The LGBTQ would seem to be a very obvious one. Yeah. And it's not just over Muslims, but Muslims are actively suppressed. And we see this in a militant way in France, of course, but throughout Europe now, where a lot of, I would say, you could correct me because you're the political scientist, a lot of the right-wing right-wing political populist movements are actually almost like weaponized liberal secular movements, really, because they often do support gay marriage, often quite Zionist, pro-Zionist, for example, as well. Yeah. And they're quite pro all the other things. But what they're really against are Muslims and Islam and so-called Islamism. And so it's not, there's a lot of propaganda here, I would suggest, about the self-presentation of these ideologies,
yeah,
where the reality in practice, and it's pretty obvious, is actually quite different. And the danger is we get taken in by the way the progressive ideology articulates itself as if it's an honest broker when it comes to its own ideology. I would suggest, or may suggest, actually that's not true. And we know it's not true because their actions belie their rhetoric. And there is a hierarchy, so much for equality, so much for diversity. We're dealing with old-fashioned privileging of some groups over others. And the bottom of the pile, I would suggest, very often are Muslims.
No doubt about it. Yeah, no doubt about it. And actually, you know, there's something else going on here, because, of course, the Muslim moral agenda, if we want to call it that, contravenes some of the precepts of liberalism. You know, yeah, they would see it as, this is anti-equality, this is anti-freedom, anti-autonomy, anti-individualism. And so one needs to fight against that Muslim agenda, whereas the, say, the LGBTQ agenda doesn't do that. It affirms those liberal values. And that's, you know, I interviewed Tom Fahini a while back about the liberal state. And you know, he made a fascinating, you know, you've interviewed him on a number of occasions. He made a very good point about how the neutral state is actually a fabrication. In reality, the state does favor some groups over others because, of course, the neutral state, the ultimate aim of the neutral state is to create good liberals. It's to create a type of society that displays liberal values. And by the way, Will Kimlicker, who is, you know, this liberal multiculturalist, he's under no illusion that that is the end result of the liberal state. Bhikkhu Parekh, who's a multiculturalist but not a liberal multiculturalist, argues that, you know, the real agenda behind liberal multiculturalism is to create good little liberals. It's basically to get cultural communities to feel comfortable in their own skin. And within time, they embrace and adopt the very thick values of liberal society. And, you know, I think, you know, Bhikkhu Parekh is great because he once said this is liberal narcissism. You know, this is a form of a liberal agenda that wants to change people rather than to genuinely live side by side with Muslims in an era of tolerance. And actually, we can see that when it comes to Muslim representation. You know, a lot of us ask ourselves, we ask ourselves the question, you know, why is it that we've got such parlous, such problematic Muslim representation? Mm. You know, in the United States, you've got left-leaning congressmen and women who endorse all sorts of very problematic positions and actually work against sometimes the Muslim community. In Britain, we've got right-leaning and left-leaning Muslims. You know, okay, Sajid Javid comes to mind. Okay, I suspect he doesn't call himself a Muslim anymore. But nevertheless, you've got Muslims, you've got Muslim-sounding names who endorse extremely problematic positions, whether socially or politically. So the question that comes to mind is, okay, but why? Why do we, and some Muslims say, by the way, well, maybe we've got to do it better. Maybe we've got to get better Muslim representatives, you know, more devout Muslims. But I can tell you, and, you know, I'm not, again, trying to personally attack someone like I forgot his name now, Al-Mayor Sadiq Khan. I'm not trying to personally defame him, but Sadiq Khan, you know, is a practicing Muslim. He is someone who prays regularly. I was in South London the other day and they say, you know, he regularly attends the Jummah prayer. He regularly fasts in Ramadan. You know, there was that famous Brexit debate where halfway through the debate, he broke his fast by sipping some water. You know, there was gushing praise for how tolerant Britain is to allow and enable a practicing Muslim mayor in one of the most important cities in the world. Well, that's not the case. Liberal multiculturalism comes with its own trade-offs, its quid pro quo. I mean, the idea behind representation is that the only people that will rise to the top are the ones that are willing to make the concessions to the liberal state and to the liberal ideology. That's the only, you know, that's the, and so there's a structural issue, to use a left-wing term, by the way, but there is a structural issue here, which is that even if you are the most devout Muslim, if you want to get to the highest positions of political power, you have to make trade-offs. And that's the representation that Muslims will get from the liberal state. And by the way, Sadiq Khan's, you know, trade-offs have been very problematic. You know, we've talked about the social trade-offs that he's made, but actually very little is said about some of his political positions, particularly his positions towards Zionism in Israel. You know, when he became mayor, the first thing he did was to court the pro-Israeli groups. In fact, his first meeting was with the then ambassador to the UK, Mark Regev. Now, Mark Regev made his name as the chief propagandist for the Israeli state. And, you know, he justified all sorts of bloodlust that the Netanyahu government conducted against Muslims in the West Bank and in particular Gaza. You know, he's not a person who has an ounce of liking for Muslims or for Palestinians. Yet, you know, Sadiq Khan has cozied up to this person to the point where he's now, you know, Sadiq Khan condemned the boycott movement against Israel.
Did he?
And when people questioned him as to why he had become silent on Palestine, he said that City Hall is not a pulpit for foreign affairs, right? So like, you know, I'm not a foreign policy guy. Okay, fine, if you want to take that position. Yet when Russia invaded Ukraine, City Hall had the Ukrainian flag all over it. He sent out multiple tweets that were pro-Ukraine and anti-Russian. So wait a minute, there is a cause here, as you quite rightly said, Paul, there is a cause here, which is in line with liberal sensitivities. So that cause is acceptable for him to propagate and to embrace. But of course, inconvenient causes, Muslim causes, are not. I mean, if you do a Google, a Twitter search of, you know, Sadiq Khan and all of the Muslim causes, you find that he doesn't go there. You know, he's not going to talk about Kashmir anymore. He's not going to talk about Uyghur Muslims. He's not going to talk about Palestine. These are not issues that, because there are inconvenient issues for a representative who's got aspirations for higher office, these are inconvenient issues for them.
And it's great irony, because there's some people on the far right who are, you know, worried about having Muslim politicians, you know, running our cities, but these Muslim politicians are not ruling by Islamic values or politics at all. They are, personally, they may be praying five times a day, going on Hajj, as you say, but in terms of their political ideology and the campaigns and causes they endorse and talk about, they're indistinguishable from all the other politicians. So it's a very an ironic criticism. That I think it's just because they're brown, I think, or have the label. There's no actual substance to the objection at all.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, we could talk about Hamza Yousaf in Scotland, and again, you know, his positions, and you know about Kate Forbes, who was his competitor in that SNP leadership election. Well, Kate Forbes was far more honest. I mean, in fact, she went to a point where she was questioned about whether relations outside of marriage would be acceptable in her worldview. And she said, no, I can't find myself agreeing with that, right? Which is very rare, by the way, for any Western politician to say, you know, to be that clear about these sorts of matters. Okay, she did later on resolve from her position when the press picked up on it and you know attacked her for it, but nevertheless, you know, she was very clear that I have these personal moral issues, and I can't contravene them, you know, in my public utterances. Well, Hamza Yousaf was more than ready to contradict us. Now, of course, you know, to give him benefit of the doubt, he may be doing that because he knows that he's got to make those trade-offs in order to be, in order to have those political, in order to be in political office and to be in high political office as First Minister of Scotland. But I personally find that very problematic for a practicing Muslim to say some of those things that he said. It's really unacceptable. So, what are we confronting as Muslims? I know I want to bring this back to the original discussion. What are we confronting? Well, the right wing and the left wing are all liberals. And what we're confronting is what John Gray calls the two faces of liberalism. And that is that there is a variety of liberalism that may sound kind and generous and tolerant. But his point is more often than not, it isn't that face that holds political office. It's really the face of a more assertive liberalism, a universalist liberalism, That, you know, in his book, Two Faces of Liberalism, by the way, John Gray has just this week published a book which I haven't, I'm yet to read, but it's gained some great reviews on the liberal. I can't remember. It's a nice title, the Leviathans, the Modern Leviathans, I think it is. And again, it's a critique of liberalism. And John Gray is a great writer and actually very succinct in his written style. So we're confronting this universalist liberalism, whether it's the right or the left. They both embrace this universal liberalism. They just pick on different aspects of liberalism as sticks to beat the Muslim community with.
We should have learned this lesson a long time ago with the French Revolution, which was all about liberty and freedom and so on. Mm. And within a year or so, it actually the word terrorism and terrorists was actually coined to describe what the French did and during the Reign of Terror, when they literally, in the name of freedom and liberty, executed tens of thousands of people. It became a brutal terrorist state. So liberalism has a dark side to it. It always has. That's my point. It's not just like, oh, look at these recent developments. It's always had this good and evil kind of two faces, as you put it.
Absolutely. I mean, think about, you know, the so-called great liberal Tony Blair and his invasions, you know, across the Middle East and the way he justified those invasions. Yeah. It was all, you know, the justification was liberal interventionism, was humanitarian intervention, was human rights. These are liberal precepts that he's using to justify, you know, horrible wars in, you know, the greater Muslim world. Mm-hmm. So my last point really is that if the left and the right endorse positions, political, social, moral, economic positions that we may find troubling, and maybe there are some overlaps, but more often than not, we find very troubling. Should we really, embrace the right or the left? And, you know, unfortunately, and I, you know, without focusing too much on my American Muslim brothers, I do feel that American Muslims sometimes, I think it's changing now, but sometimes they show a political naivety, and I hope that's not too harsh. When for example, when George W. Bush was fighting for political office, was contesting elections, I remember in 2000, American Muslims said that we must vote for George Bush because the Clinton era was very immoral, socially immoral. So we must now vote for George Bush Jr. And of course, within a year, he starts this crusade against the Muslim world, and of course, the Iraq War was a disastrous war against Muslims. And so, you know, after that period, Muslims in America said we must embrace, you know, Barack Obama, because Barack Obama is going to show, you know, these left-leaning liberals have been far more kinder to Muslims. So let's vote for Barack Obama. And then Barack Obama, you know, again, has a very repulsive, problematic foreign policy against Muslims. But also that's where we see the rollout of a lot of these very problematic social programs in schools across America. So we have to move away from this left-right duopoly. And my discussions with Muslim leaders across the West has made me realize that there is now an appetite for political independence. And the securitized straitjacket of the war on terror has now dissipated. And so we're carving out a space that I think is more authentic and more principled. And so we're becoming more warier of the demands of the left and the right. Now, of course, there are some people who remain, you know, politically naive and will jump into any political bandwagon in order to find some short-term political gains. But I don't think that's the trend. In fact, I think that what we're seeing, you know, these demonstrations and protests that we're seeing are actually a sign of a maturity within the Muslim community. And one shouldn't, if a non-Muslim is watching this show, they shouldn't observe those trends through the prism of the left-right culture wars. That's not what's happening here. These are authentic Muslim activists and scholars and thinkers who are now taking very an independent stand and endorsing which I call, authentic Muslim positions. I mean, Omar Suleiman, Imam Omar Suleiman, he mentioned, I think, a very good point about the left and right. He said that this is not a political realignment. Muslims have been at the receiving end of the animus from both sides for years. One side seemingly wants to annihilate you, and the other side only accepts you if you're willing to assimilate. Now, I know there's people who criticize.
I think that's entirely accurate. I mean, I don't want to take sides in this, but Dr. Omar Suleiman has been perceived, at least, to have been tracking quite close to the Democrat Party's liberal progressive causes for some considerable time. And to say that he resists this claim, is not a political realignment, some might say that it was, because now he is reasserting, particularly on the LGBT issue, the traditional Orthodox Sunni Muslim. People perceive that he wasn't before, or at least he was sailing close to the liberal wind. So, in fact, it would be then a political realignment from the way he had expressed his political leanings before.
I mean, look, to his credit, I mean, I remember watching a video of his, which he published a few months back, where he said, look, we made mistakes. And, the war on terror was so intense, and it was intense for American Muslims. Yeah. And they had to make these decisions. And it was the left that were defending and protecting Muslims. And I think, these people, like all Muslims, we've been on a political journey. Let's say that. And, we've realized that some of our positions have actually been highly problematic over the years. And all credit to those Muslims who come out of that, realizing that, the left and the right have got challenging stances that we as Muslims need to be far more critical of. Again, equally, Yasir Qadhi, I mean, Dr. Yasir Qadhi, who, I engage with quite a lot. And my engagement with him has been very positive. And I feel that, he's, again, realize and come to a very similar conclusion to Imam Omar. We're tolerated as long as we were a feather in the cap of diversity. But when we want to enforce our own personal values in our life, we are no longer tolerated. It was all a facade.
It was all a facade. I think that's an important point. It is a facade that we often get taken in by this, the Tony Blair-like smiles and apparent sincerity. And the liberal values. I mean, take it at face value as actually authentic and real. But actually, as Dr. Yasir Qadhi said, it was actually a facade. We know it's a facade because of what happened subsequently. The realities of it suggest. And who should be surprised? A politician being two-faced. A politician not being quite what he seems. What a surprise!
yeah. And what is interesting? I mean, I saw that again with American Muslims. I mean, Imam. And again, I know you. Invite Imam Tom Fakini on your show on a number of occasions. You've invited him on a number of occasions, but it's interesting. Like there is a generation of Muslim scholars who are arriving, who are far more savvy, I think, when it comes to political issues. And I think partly because he's got a political science background.
Yeah,
but. They realize these pitfalls and they are more active in explaining what's happening in wider society to young Muslims in particular. Just to run through this, very quickly, only a couple of slides left. I've spoken to a number. I mean, I've got a quote here from Imam Fakini who says, the analysis of the liberal state, it attempts to secularize the Muslim community under the guise of toleration. Liberalism presents itself as a neutral arbiter to the claims of what is a good life, but instead it endorses a universalism that seeks to dilute comprehensive doctrines like Islam. I love that quote. It's a really succinct, it expresses exactly what's going on here. And it's what your comment, Islam is a comprehensive doctrine. We believe in things. We've got values. We've got Sharia. We've got fiqh values, and these values sometimes are contested in the public space by liberals because they find these values to be repulsive and problematic and challenging, and so inevitably the liberal state will chip away at Muslims. Now, of course, the French liberal state tries to do that by very assertive programs of banning the niqab and banning the abaya in schools, and by that they think they can create and envelop the Muslim community in fear so that Muslims would have to willingly negotiate with the liberal state and make concessions.
Although I agree with that, it's actually a lot more. The French state is explicit in trying to create what they call French Islam, and they have certain imams who are on the payroll who advocate this. So they're not even pretending just to, you know, they actually say, no, we will now create a different religion for you to believe in, a privatized, secularized, liberalized, remarkably similar actually to what they've done to the Catholics. But that is explicit. They're not even pretending not to do that. Macron and others have been saying this for some time. So, you know, the Muslims there can't, you know, accept the delusion. It's just a benign neutrality. They are actually out to change the religion itself. And there's the irony here, because one of the values of the Republic, allegedly, is freedom of religion, religious freedom. But that value has almost completely disappeared now. There is no freedom if you go against this progressive, secularizing liberal state that wants to change your faith. There's no freedom then.
Yeah, that's good. And, you know, equally, the position of, say, America or Canada and the UK may look far more comfortable for them, or may look like, you know, to Muslims to be far more kinder towards the Muslim community. But there is, as I said, you know, previously, Kim Licker's view is that liberal multiculturalism, unlike the French view, which is, you know, assimilation, liberal multiculturalism has a very similar end goal. It is to create a privatized, secularized community that embraces the fixed values of liberalism, but through a gradual process and over a series of negotiations with the liberal state. So you've got, you know, and I would particularly ask your viewers to watch that interview with Tom Fakin, because I think it was a fantastic explanation of liberalism. Both the conservatives and liberal demand concessions from the Muslim community, but they differ on the criteria of what a good Muslim should look like. Again, a very nice quote. I spoke to Joseph Kaminsky, actually sent out a really great tweet on his Twitter after that Wajahat Ali article, where he said, you know, that this was a false binary. The idea is to guilt people into thinking that if they support traditional Islamic gender norms, by default, they are Trumpers. Yeah. You know, so if you're someone who believes in Islam, you're somehow a Trumper. And that's just, you know, not the reality. I spoke to Mubin Vaid, in fact, when I wrote that article in Muslim Matters. And, you know, I asked him about the alliance between Muslims and Christian groups in Michigan, which, by the way, he was one of the leaders on the ground. And did that alliance, because the way that the press, they interpreted that was, yeah, here we go, Muslims are being sucked in by the evangelicals. And, you know, his response was, well, that actually wasn't the case. These were largely Ethiopian Christians who were not a right-wing group. They probably vote the left most of the time. They probably vote Democrats, as most ethnic minorities do in America. So there wasn't this Republican plot that the media characterized those demonstrations with. I interviewed Azam Tamimi, and he made a very good point about where Muslims began to realize that the left were not just there to help us in our quest to deal with some of the war and terror, the challenges that came up, the war on terror. Dr. Azam Tamimi, who was, of course, in the UK, was instrumental. It was one of the leaders of the 2003 demonstrations against the Iraq war, where many of the trade unionists and the left movements, the Stop the War Coalition, united with the Muslim community. In fact, a large number of those who came out to demonstrate were Muslims in 2003. And, you know, he was very candid about that period, actually, with me. He said that, look, we did embrace the left, but the Arab Spring was the turning point, because the left failed to see that the people of Syria and Libya were genuinely rising up against dictatorship. The left characterized the Arab Spring as an imperialist movement, and they characterized that host situation as Western imperialism. You know, Assad, in other words, was anti-imperialism. Saddam Hussein was anti-imperialism, and the movements against these dictators were actually paid by Western imperialists. In the same way, by the way, the left today, they deny the Uyghur cultural genocide, because they They argue that Uyghur Muslims are being utilized by the right, by the or by the liberal right, in order to cast, you know, to cast the Chinese as enemies of the West, right?
Yeah.
So you know, there is a political maturity that has developed in the Muslim community. Mazen Beck said something very similar about the catalyst was the Syria conflict, and later what happened in China, in East Turkestan, in with the Uyghurs. The left were too ready to embrace an anti-imperialist narrative and thus denied the genocide and mass repression. What I found after speaking to so many Muslims is Muslims have woken up to this left-wing duopoly, the problems of the left and the right, and are now moving beyond that. So how are they moving beyond that? Well, we've got a completely different framework of thinking beyond the left-right political spectrum. When I give my course, Islam and Liberalism, I often ask a question to Muslims, like, I lay out the left-right political spectrum, and I say to them, where do you fit on that spectrum? And of course, naturally, many young Muslims are going to say, well, I'm more left. And, you know, you can take tests today which say whether you're more left-wing or more right-wing or whether you're more centrist. And by the end of the course, I you know, they realize that we actually fit nowhere on that spectrum, because we've got a completely different ideational outlook that enables Muslims to look at positions or look at political, social, economic, moral positions from a completely different framework.
But so it's important to restate that, to have a different take on what you said there. Yeah. It's not that we're neither right or left, but that Muslims find aspects and policies and principles in the right and left they agree with. So the right, the traditional right's emphasis on family values and so on is something that Muslims say, yeah, we're right wing to the extent that that is a right wing value, but also on the left because we believe in social justice, we believe in and so on as well. So it's not that we're neither, but we're both, but not ideologically. I suppose Islam is not ideologically derived from right and left. It has its own independent position based on the Quran, the Sunnah, and the Sharia, but it does actually find itself affirming positions across the board, if you see what I mean.
You're right. And I remember, as you were saying that, the quote, the speech of Umar ibn al-Khattab, radiallahu anhum, who said that whatever disagrees with Islam is un-Islam, is non-Islam.
Yeah.
Fine. Whatever agrees with Islam is also non-Islam, un-Islam, right? And it's a good point. You know, just because there may be congruences, there may be agreements, it doesn't mean that we are left wing or right wing. Now, of course, I accept your point. You know, we live in a society in a world where the vocabulary of the left and the right dominates our thinking, and so inevitably, in order to express ourselves, we may end up using that vocabulary. My argument is, let's not use that vocabulary. Let's find a different set of words and phrases to characterize what a Muslim is and where a Muslim stands. And by doing that, by the way, that's a dawah, because that shows non-Muslim society that there is something different about these people. There is a quality to them where they may agree, for example, on social morality. I mean, you know, for example, Peter Hitchens comes to mind, who you said, you know, and we agreed, generally speaking, his positions on drugs and his positions on certain moral themes are very positive. I remember, in fact, he was on the Moral Maze, I think it was, a few weeks back. If I'm not mistaken, it was a Moral Maze, where he was asked about, what's your position on civil marriages? And he said, look, I have no problem with that, you know, as long as it's marriage. So there are, of course, even for traditional conservatives, there are concessions that he's made with the liberal state.
Really?
His problem is with, you know, with trans rights and with, so, you know, he recognizes that there are some, that there are the discourse has moved on and we can't fight those battles. Well, Muslims actually are willing to fight those battles. We wouldn't accept for our child to come home and say, you know, meet my gay boyfriend or girlfriend. That's just wouldn't be acceptable.
Yeah, essentially, I didn't realize Peter Hitchens had said that, actually. If you had asked me in advance what he would have said, I would have said, no, he wouldn't have agreed with that. So even my slight admiration for him is diminished, because he has compromised his principled Christian faith to accommodate liberal positions, which normally he wouldn't wish to do, but I think as a general principle, but he clearly has, though, in this case.
I think he was on a panel with lots of left-leaning people, and in a way, he didn't want that to be the focus of you know, his critique, and so he ended up, you know, he ended up being forced into saying that, I suspect, after a few questions, he ended up saying that. But nevertheless, even traditional conservatives may find themselves acquiescing with the liberal state. Now, you know, we're different. We know where our red lines are. And, you know, we as Muslims have a firm belief that, look, Islam is the truth. It's correct. Of course, we're not, you know, our position doesn't mean that we discriminate here in the West against people who may hold different positions. But certainly, when it comes to ourselves and our family, you know, we're very clear on what those red lines are. And we would teach our children the normative Islamic positions on these issues. So my second point actually is that the left and the right are going to cynically exploit the Muslim community for short-term political ends. And I think there needs to be political savvy people within the Muslim community, for want of a better term, who are able to point out those discrepancies in their way of thinking. And I personally lastly believe that we need to move beyond these left-right labels and craft a confident Muslim community that tackles some of our problems. You know, the other day I was invited by some mosque leaders in a part of London to talk to them about my views towards how they could be better dealing with some of the challenges that many young Muslims face. And my response to them was, look, if you have to address these challenges, and part of addressing these challenges is to address the ideological onslaught many of the young Muslims face. Now, by the way, in that room, I had some kickback, and some mosque leaders said, you know, I think you're exaggerating, you know. And luckily, there were some young Muslims in the room, and they, at the end of a conversation, they put their hands up. And, you know, it's very brave of them, by the way, because you had the great and the good of this community in the room, and they put their hands up and said, no, we agree entirely. You know, you don't know what's happening in our colleges. You don't know what's happening. You know, there could be a young Muslim who comes in wearing a hijab and after 2 years leaves with very problematic moral positions because of the indoctrination, for want of a better term, that the education system is heaping on those young Muslims, but also just the general cultural engagement these young Muslims are having on social media. It's changing their framework of thinking. So what's my point? My point is, we do have a host of challenges, and the Muslim community have to independently address these challenges. And by the way, many of these challenges are just not going to be embraced by either the left or the right, because they don't see these as problems for their framework of thinking. So I think we've got to do less of, we've got to think less about the macro politics, dare I say, and start thinking about building good, confident community, because only then are we going to be a dower to the wider society around us. So jazakallah khair. In fact, Paul, I promised to speak for, I think, 20 or 30 minutes, and I've gone on for over an hour, and I'm really sorry about that.
And I've been adding fuel to the fire every 5 minutes, so I think the fault is mine, if it is a fault. No, thank you very much. I think I'm reminded that something that Tim Winter said, Abdul Hakim Murad, perhaps controversially, but I think it might be true. He said the first generation of Muslim immigrants to the West, or Britain, America, came here primarily as economic migrants. They were looking for a better quality of life, and, you know, who can blame them for that, I guess. But that wasn't really a Sharia reason. It's not really to do dawah. And so when they came here to get jobs and build homes and so on, so in a sense that their children and their grandchildren are now reaping that, in that they find themselves in countries which have very little, if any, sympathy for their Islamic faith. And it's a big problem for them. And it's a problem that we have created, in that we have not come here with the mindset to, historically anyway, to do dawah, to safeguard our identities. And maybe later, maybe now we're playing catch up now. But, you know, you know, that I think historically it kind of makes sense. So this problem to some extent is of our own making and not perhaps, you know, but yeah, maybe I'm not expressing that terribly well, but I think
that's important. You're right. You're absolutely right. And there is some of that for sure, I think. I agree with some of what Abdulhakim Murad says there about, you know, the intentions of the early Muslims. But again, we have to recognize that those Muslims also face intense racism, and they faced, you know, all sorts of discrimination in the workplace. And so they had a host of issues that, alhamdulillah, we don't really have to contend with. At least, you know, people of my generation, my father came to Britain in the early 70s. The type of discrimination he faced is not, you know, and actually they came from societies in the Indian subcontinent, for example, that were ravaged by war and colonialism before that. So, you know, there is a context to their migration. My father didn't want to move to Britain. You know, he loved India. He loved his little village in India. And, you know,
probably many of these people actually came here, but they didn't intend to stay here forever. Yeah. And they wanted to go back, but they didn't. Yeah. So that's another thing. Yeah.
Well, for sure. And that is the migrant story, right? You know, no one really very few expected to bring up children in this country.
Yeah. Finally, they are bringing up children. And of course, in a society that's profoundly unsympathetic, not just because of racism, because of just generally anti-religious or anti-Muslim attitudes. And then we wonder why their children are being brainwashed in schools. Well, yeah, we would be, given we have placed them in these places. I mean, to put it harshly, I don't mean intentionally doing that, of course. But so it's an element of we have created this problem ourselves. But you know, this is life, and we have to deal with it. And I think Muslims are dealing with it now increasingly better, becoming maturer in their responses and learning the lessons that have to be learned, and with political commentators and such as yourself helping some insightful analysis of what's going on, what needs to change. So yeah, maybe ultimately it will be a success story,
inshallah ta'ala. And actually there are some very positive, you know, as you said, and as Abdulhakim Murad said, in fact, in a talk I listened to of his, where, you know, generally speaking, as society gets more darker, and problems, problems develop in those societies, and you know, mental health problems, and as individualism embeds itself, and non-Muslim society in general finds itself, you know, in a very chaotic society. In fact, society is absent from many of their lives. Mm. You know, it is still the Muslim community with all of our imperfections that a lot of them turn to. You know, you had Ahmed Dabous from Lewisham Mosque on your show not too long ago, who I also interviewed. And, you know, it's amazing what he's doing and what his community are doing in Lewisham.
Yeah.
You know, this is a socioeconomically very poor community. Yet they see, you know, I think he gave an example of Muslims who come out of the mosque and they hug each other and they talk to one another and they hang around and they seem to have very jovial conversations with one another. And there are black Muslims and white Muslims in Asia. And it seems to be a very cosmopolitan mosque, and people are, you know, in a society of doom and gloom, people are pretty generous towards one another, and they show very good qualities in their general lives. Well, that type of community is going to be an invitation to
others. Oh, yeah. I mean, but yeah, he's doing outstanding work. Amazing. And that is the future of a successful Muslim community, attracting others, doing dawah by its very presence, really, by its life. Absolutely. Yeah. No, there are causes for hope, absolutely, in the UK and elsewhere.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Mohammed Jalal, for your very, very interesting analysis. And I said before, I will link to the Muslim Matters article and the Substack link as well, and anything else I can think to throw in underneath, so that people can follow up. Oh, the Imam Tom interview is worth putting on the Thinking Muslim podcast, which I've seen. Definitely worth watching that if you haven't already. So thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Until next time. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum.